I'm Dr. Alice Sheridan, and I'm the director of editing of NEFSAP. And I'm here with Dr. Martina McGrath, who is also an editor of NEFSAP. And we're here today to interview Dr. Ron Wald. Dr. Wald, as all of us know, has been a nephrologist at St. Michael's Hospital and the director of the hospital's hemodialysis program. He is a professor of medicine at the University of Toronto. Dr. Wald is a native of Montreal. He completed his undergraduate and medical degrees at McGill and then continued his clinical training in internal medicine and nephrology at the University of Toronto. He completed a Master of Public Health at Harvard and a research fellowship at Tufts Medical Center in Boston. Actually, Dr. Wald, I did not know you had Boston roots. I mean, that's
Absolutely. Great 2 years of our life here in Boston.
His current research is critical care nephrology and maintenance dialysis. He was a co-principal investigator of the START trial, a Canadian Institute of Research of Health research-funded international trial on the timing of dialysis initiation. He also is interested in fluid management in the setting of AKI and the long-term outcome of patients who survive an episode of AKI in the realm of maintenance dialysis. He is on the leadership team of the multinational phosphate trial that is evaluating whether intensive lowering of serum phosphate reduces the risk of major adverse cardiovascular events. Well, that's a lot. Thank you very, very much for being here today. We really appreciate your input. In your editorial, you talked about a kind of a golden entering a golden era of investigative trials, particularly in renal replacement. And I'm wondering, you raised some data we now know that initiating dialysis based on the creatinine does not provide benefit. In fact, it may be associated with worse outcomes. And you focused on three large areas: the dose of dialysis, the method by which we discontinue dialysis, and the method by which we dialyze people. Do you care to speculate of the outcomes? And let me preface this, and then I'll be quiet for a bit and hear you. When I was interviewing Dr. Pilevsky years ago about one of the initiation trials, he described going into the trial and expecting the exact opposite result. Paul had written the paper with the outcome that early initiation would improve outcomes. And he described his surprise and then almost his elation of finding an unexpected result based on sound data. And it clearly, those initial trials changed how we practice critical care nephrology. Do you care to speculate? What do you anticipate for the outcome of the dose intensity?
Thank you very much, Dr. Sheridan. I just want to first begin by saying that it's an honor for me to have been asked to write this editorial. I certainly learned a lot by putting it together, despite the fact that I'm deeply embedded in this field, both clinically and research-wise. You learned so much from the opportunity to contribute to NEFSAP. So I think that I speculate that the dose trials will ultimately not demonstrate any inferiority of lower dosing thresholds. I think that we have to appreciate the fact that the current standard was, in fact, somewhat arbitrary in that it was merely the control group in the high versus low intensity dose trials, the classic ones, of course, being the ATN trial and the renal trial. And almost by default, because there was no evidence of superiority of more intense therapy, the 20 to 25 mils per kilo per hour became the standard. And of course, we know that the effluent flow is very, very vital for clearance. It really represents clearance when you do continuous kidney replacement therapy. But in addition, there's so much more when we administer this therapy to patients than just urea clearance. It's about fluid balance, acid-base control of hyperkalemia, which are probably much more relevant in the acute setting than it might be in the chronic setting. Of course, we know that the so-called KT over V is also a dubious marker in end-stage kidney disease. So my suspicion is that we will demonstrate that the lower dose that the various pilot trials are currently testing are going to be non-inferior to the what is currently the standard 20 to 25 mils per kilo per hour.
If they're non-inferior, would you speculate, all the issues certainly that you have with CRRT, hypophosphatemia, et cetera, that may end up being a benefit to perhaps dialyze to clinical indication. Is that what your
Absolutely,
suspicion is?
and I think that we hopefully will avoid complications like hypophosphatemia, the compromise of antibiotic doses that we want to maintain in the blood. Probably, certainly more; those are much more important things than the actual urea clearance that a patient in the ICU with sepsis. It's a, the antibiotic levels are probably much more important to them, I should say, than the urea clearance that they have. I think that. And certainly, if we demonstrate non-inferiority, it'll be, an opportunity to save resources as well in terms of fluids and other disposables. But again, this is why we have to do the trials. I think that it's really, really vital that we ask ourselves why we're doing what we're doing in the ICU and every aspect of nephrology. And the reason I said it's a golden era is that before we kind of accepted a lot of dogmas. And a lot of evidence-based medicine rather than evidence-based medicine in the world of dialysis and certainly in the world of critical care nephrology. And the naysayers said that these are just too hard to recruit. It's too hard to recruit into these trials. Well, the patients are too sick. It's too intense a setting. It's hard to get consent in the right time frame and implement the protocols. But in fact, I think the large trials that have been completed and starting with the ATN and renal trials of the late 2000s, the subsequent ones that followed also demonstrated that yes, we can do good research in a very, very challenging setting. So I'm convinced that the fact that we're taking on, we as a field are taking on a variety of trials, testing different strategies in the setting of AKI is really great news.
Dr. Wald, I was fascinated by your editorial, but also by your comments about urea clearance as an outcome. And I guess one question, looking at where the field has come from and where maybe it's going in the future, is urea clearance maybe the wrong thing to look at? And is there something else that you think we should be designing these trials to test?
Yeah, it's the million-dollar question in the world of extracorporeal therapy, both acute and chronic. I don't think urea is certainly a convenient marker to follow. It's easy to measure, but I think that we all see patients who get excellent urea clearance, certainly in the chronic setting, yet they're not doing so well necessarily. I wish we had that elusive biomarker that kind of is a surrogate for all the terrible things that happen in both acute and chronic kidney failure. We just don't have that yet. So I think, and certainly in the world of acute dialysis, our focus should be on, first of all, minimizing harm, ensuring that the therapies we deliver to our patients are safe, devoid of, or to the extent possible, of iatrogenic toxicity, ensuring that we're focused on the things that help the patient globally get better, like fluid removal, and use our renal support mechanisms to help patients hopefully get off ventilators faster. So, and of course, maintain electrolyte acid-base homeostasis, which are so crucial as well. So, I think that we probably have to get away from the notion that removal of uremic toxins, even especially because we don't know which what they are the essence of treating acute kidney injury when we administer renal replacement therapy, but rather, helping the patient globally get better and do so in a safe manner.
You mentioned that one might look at subgroups, that there are subgroups of patients that could benefit from either more intensive therapy or earlier initiation. And you used oliguria. And clearly, there's data now that oliguria imparts a separate prognostic factor to the KDIGO criteria of AKI. And yet oliguria is it's the most common clinical indicator. How do you use oliguria? Should we be dialyzing earlier based on more modest measures of oliguria? Should we dialyze prior to using diuretics? Any speculation there?
Yeah, so I think the IDEAL ICU trial, one of the so-called timing trials that was completed in France, in a secondary analysis showed that patients whose acute kidney injury was diagnosed based on oliguria rather than serum creatinine criteria, those individuals seemed to do better with an earlier initiation strategy. And it was a small trial, a post-hoc analysis, and is hypothesis generating. My thought was that perhaps oliguria is just representative of, as compared to non-oliguria, is representative of a patient who is, number one, in worse shape, whose kidneys are in worse shape and are less likely to imminently recover. So you might as well get them going on renal replacement therapy. Perhaps that might be part of the explanation. And it might also just correlate with worse prognostic signs that are evident in those types of patients, individuals who are just inherently sicker. And the oliguria is a manifestation of that. But I think this is something that will have to be clarified in other trials and maybe in future trials. We hope to do this analysis within the START-AKI trial at some point. But I think that it certainly highlights the fact that we are proud of the work that we've done in the area of renal replacement therapy initiation. The last thing we would want is for our results to be taken excessively dogmatically. We showed that really early initiation of renal replacement therapy probably isn't beneficial, but there may be patients who still benefit because we know that when we find patients and recruit them into these trials, they're at various stages of their AKI history, and sometimes it's they're really not all created equal, even though they all have a time zero. The time of randomization in the trial is not doesn't necessarily put all the patients at a common time zero in terms of their history of acute kidney injury. And so judgment is needed, and it certainly would be wrong in my view, as I stated in the editorial, to allow for the protracted persistence of AKI without renal replacement therapy based on the findings of these trials. The trials simply found that you probably don't do any better by starting renal replacement therapy in the first, say, 10 hours of the patient's time in the trial as compared to waiting for a couple more days. But beyond a couple of days, I don't think we have data on that. And I wouldn't want our trials to imply that it's okay to wait forever in the setting with AKI and adopt kind of a nihilistic approach. I think the patients have to be followed very carefully. Their fluid balance needs to be monitored, the trajectory of their illness. And it would be wrong to withhold renal replacement therapy for an infinite period of time.
Sure. And yet to put an arbitrary cutoff, it also seems perhaps unwise. I think you had mentioned 72 hours. And yet somebody with an intact mental status and good fluid balance who's making urine, I've watched a number of patients before 72, hoping that they'll turn around, sometimes to no avail, of course. Just to shift slightly to withdrawal of dialysis. I know Qishu had come out with the observational data suggesting that all of us are perhaps not following our AKI patients in the outpatient dialysis centers as closely as we would like. And all of this, the suggestion, I believe, correct me here, is that perhaps we should be looking more closely at recovery of kidney function and taper dialysis back. All of it tends to lead toward the speculation that dialysis is impeding kidney recovery. Is that what you believe?
I think so. I think that we know from our end-stage kidney disease patients that hemodialysis after is often associated with the loss of residual kidney function. And we assume it relates to hemodynamic insults that occur to the on hemodialysis, perhaps the exposure to inflammation that the dialysis circuit causes. So if one accepts that, and I think there's pretty good data to support that, in the setting of acute kidney injury, the last thing you would want to do is to compromise endogenous kidney function in a patient who has a good chance of recovering. I think that is the general theme of Qi's excellent work in this area. I think that he essentially tries to send the message that we shouldn't be treating patients who have AKI with a good forecast of recovery as in the same way as we treat patients who are initiating maintenance dialysis. And when one shifts from the inpatient acute setting to the outpatient setting, which is dominated by a philosophy of maintenance dialysis, but after all, that's what outpatient dialysis clinics are designed to administer, you just have to remember these are not end-stage kidney disease patients yet. We're hoping they might end up being that despite our best efforts, but we have to do our best to give them a chance to recover. And how we do that is the area that's controversial. We have a trial that's going on in Canada now that parallels the study that the group in the US is doing, Qi and Kathleen Liu and others. And I think they're all trying to get at this notion of, let's try to be minimalistic about dialysis when we have evidence that the patient is showing signs of kidney recovery and give that individual the best chance to recover. And the way to do that, although both trials are doing it somewhat different ways, is let's only dialyze if there's a really good reason to do so and kind of see what happens to the patient.
I agree. I certainly agree, and would await those trials with interest. My only concern is, I think Chi actually mentioned this in one of his papers, is that most patients who end up on outpatient dialysis for AKI have pre-existing CKD, and although they may get recovery, how much? If you give the patient a GFR of 13 to 15 mils per minute, that's the point where I'm thinking of, I'm afraid I haven't gotten an access into them by then. And I just worry a little bit that for many patients, we're going to set them up for a false hope and perhaps 6 months off dialysis before they have to restart. Are there any data on degree of recovery in this population?
Yeah, I wish we had better data. I think that the notion of risk stratification is very important here. I think when a patient with acute kidney injury is discharged from hospital and still requiring dialysis, we have to have some kind of sense is, okay, is this really, this patient will have a high likelihood of recovery? And of course, their baseline GFR is probably the most important prognostic factor. Having said that, I would push back a bit, Dr. Sheridan, and say that, if you can. If a patient who had severe AKI, even on the background of advanced CKD, say a GFR of 18 before he or she got sick, and if you can get them back to that GFR of 15, at least to make them dialysis independent, even if it's for a short period of time, it might not be forever, but 6 months off dialysis, 12 months off dialysis, enough time to get an access in, to get dialysis education done, not to mention the opportunity of being dialysis free and living a dialysis-free life for an extra 6 to 12 months, I'd still think that's a win. So even in patients with advanced CKD who might eventually go back to chronic dialysis at some point in the future. And we do know that there's a lot of patients who commence dialysis for end-stage kidney disease who had short stints on dialysis in the context of AKI in the past. And so I think there's still opportunities to give people a dialysis-free interval. I think it's worth
That I completely agree with, and more importantly, my patients would absolutely agree with
Thank
you. Sometimes just imparting the importance of urine output to them and the hope that they could recover makes them very careful, like monitors of their own potential recovery, which is useful. I'm not sure how things are in Canada, but here in the United States, we need a more streamlined approach to documenting kidney recovery that we currently have in the outpatient realm, for sure.
The key, I think, is good sign over, and it just needs to be, really clearly conveyed to patients practicing in the outpatient world that This patient does have hope of recovery. This is what you might consider doing to assess recovery. That's the best we can do right now. And also consider the notion of giving people a chance of doing what's so-called decremental dialysis. In other words, they might still need dialysis, but maybe they only need it twice a week. And that's that opportunity to observe kidney recovery in a more rigorous way.
Now, something slightly offline. I don't know if you had, there was an article in AJKD by Jonathan Himmelfarb and his team looking at subphenotypes of AKI and prognostic, as almost prognostic markers. And the phenotypes, one of them clearly was characterized by a more inflammatory state, with markers of endothelial injury. TNF receptor is activated, interleukin 6, and a number of interleukins are activated. I think the idea behind this, and this is certainly started in the critical care literature, is that perhaps we could obtain a biomarker profile of patients and predict. Any thoughts as to how we might use that in defining the need for dialysis in the future? Potentially outpatient recovery.
I think really what you're describing really is the holy grail of precision medicine, and I would really admire people who are doing work in this area. I think it just right now what we're doing is treating all patients with AKI in kind of the same way, applying even our starting rules and is to renal replacement therapy in the setting of AKI is extremely rudimentary and imprecise. And if we, I think the promise of subphenotyping, understanding individuals who are destined to have a worse outcome and or have a different pathophysiology underlying their AKI might actually enable us to treat people somewhat more aggressively or in some less aggressively. By the same token, it might open up the notion of streamlining patients for clinical trials. A lot of new products are being touted for AKI prevention, perhaps even some for AKI therapy. There's a lot of interest in different forms of extracorporeal therapy using hemoadsorption as a adjunct to conventional renal replacement therapy. And though I've been generally a skeptic about novel extracorporeal approaches and binding different cytokines and endotoxin, which we know probably isn't helpful, I think there may be a subgroup of patients who do benefit. And this work in the area of subphenotyping might help us identify just those patients who might be perfect for clinical trials to test these new devices.
Well, I will also wait for that holy grail in that case. I think you've covered most eloquently all of my questions. Did you have anything, Martina?
Yeah, I was interested in these studies that are being developed looking at ultrafiltration rates, because obviously this is something that has really come into vogue in the outpatient setting for hemodialysis, but we have not really had any kind of guidelines or thresholds for how we would handle this in the ICU. Can you just tell us a little bit about what you think of those data?
Yeah, thank you so much. I think that it always bugged me that the KDIGO guidelines on AKI never touched on ultrafiltration and ultrafiltration rates, even though it's probably the single most important thing we do for patients in it with renal replacement therapy in the ICU. And I think it's understandable why, because it's actually so hard to assess volume status in critically ill patients. And there's even some subjectivity in patients who are not critically ill. But I think that, we have almost this, dichotomy of observations. Number one is that fluid overload and persistent fluid overload is a bad thing. And those individuals who become more negative volume-wise seem to do better after they start renal replacement therapy. On the other hand, there are data that suggests that more aggressive ultrafiltration rates are associated with adverse outcomes, and that perhaps has to do with hemodynamic instability that's induced by higher ultrafiltration rates is not totally clear. So it's almost a bit of a paradox here that needs to be sorted out. Basically, we know that making people more negative might be a good thing. It might help them. It might help wean them from mechanical ventilation more quickly. It might help with their mobility by mitigating edema, but it also comes with dangers and dangers of too rapid an ultrafiltration rate. And that's what I think the trials are trying to sort out. There are two trials, one in Canada that's based in Canada, one that's based in the US, that are looking at this very concept of two approaches to fluid removal, one that is more aggressive, one that is more conservative. The American trial is coming at it from the perspective that a less aggressive approach is better. In other words, lower ultrafiltration rates might be safer, and indeed they might be right. Our approach in Canada is actually a bit the opposite, is we believe that patients are left fluid overloaded in the ICU for way too long, despite being on the ultimate form of therapy to mitigate fluid overload, which is extracorporeal therapy. And so in our intervention arm, we're trying to be deliberately aggressive to within with clinical clinician breaks put on that to get fluid off of patients, and as a compared to a strategy of usual care where we let the clinicians do what they feel is most appropriate. And at least this is we're in the pilot phase of our research program. The goal is really to see that we can demonstrate a separation between the two groups with respect to fluid balance after 5 days in the ICU. So that will, and hopefully, if we can demonstrate that degree of feasibility with our protocol, we'll be able to move on to a larger trial that's based on patient-centered, clinically relevant outcomes.
Fantastic. These are not easy studies to do, and to say
No.
to actually achieve a difference between the groups in itself is a tall
Yes.
order.
And I think part of it has to do, from my initial observations, that fluid removal is one of those things that people feel passionately about. And there's often a lot of debate among clinicians between the intensivists and the nephrologists who are co-managing the patient, between nephrologists, people on the two different individuals on the nephrology team. And so the challenge we might have is, letting physicians who might feel very strongly about what a patient's fluid balance should be at the end of a day actually let the protocol guide that. And so I definitely foresee that as a challenge, but hopefully that's why we do pilot trials to learn about what is doable and what is not doable in the context of a clinical trial.
Well, that's excellent. Dr. Wald, I really would like to thank you again for your time and expertise, certainly in behalf of Martina and myself and the ASN, but also in the behalf of the nephrology community. We really appreciate what you're doing and what you brought with you today.
As I said, I really appreciate the opportunity to do this podcast and to write the editorial. I learned a lot, and we're all, it's an exciting time in the field of critical care nephrology, and hopefully there'll be more trials answering more of those questions so that the next iteration of the guidelines will have more evidence to guide our practice.
Excellent. Thank
Thank you
you.
so much.
Take care. Thank you.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.